Welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series, where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorders, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, or are responsible for, or necessarily endorse this podcast. I'm Susan P. Weinstein, President of LAPA, your host for today's podcast on obtaining substances on the dark web. My guest today is Dr. Erica Combe, Lead Digital Forensic Analyst in the Digital Forensics Lab in the Department of Research and Economic Development at Dakota State University. I first came in contact with Dr. Combe when she led a fascinating webinar on behalf of the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators, or NADDI, on the topic. Welcome, Dr. Combe, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to get started. And first, I want the listeners to understand a little bit about what your lab does and how you became an expert on the dark web.
Sure. So our lab on campus, we're on the campus of Dakota State University, which is in Madison, South Dakota, and we're a small community in eastern South Dakota. And our lab on campus is known as the DigForce Lab, which stands for Digital Forensics for Cyber Enforcement. And we're founded in 2018 as a partnership between Dakota State University, the South Dakota Division of Criminal Investigation, and the South Dakota Attorney General's Office. And we receive our funding through federal, state, and private partnerships. And we're primarily a digital forensics lab, which means we perform examinations on digital evidence that's part of a criminal investigation in the state of South Dakota. And we primarily do phones, but we also do computers, removable media drives such as a flash drive, an SD card, a GPS device. We do digital video recorders, and we've even done some research on drones. So we do all types of cases, and many of our cases are drug cases, but we also do homicide investigations, assaults, fraud investigations, crash investigations, and the only type of cases we don't do are ICAT cases, which are internet crimes against children. And the reason we don't do those are because we're not a law enforcement facility, so we don't do those. We work with a variety of local, state, and federal agencies throughout the state. And we also conduct open source investigations for the South Dakota Attorney General's Office in support of the casework that they do upon request. And Dakota State's been designated by the NSA as a center of academic excellence in the three designations of cyber research, cyber defense research, and cyber operations. And we were one of the first institutions to hold all three of those designations. And I was introduced to the dark web when I was working on my PhD by my now boss, who was doing some background research, and she asked me to start doing some research and gather information for her. And I just found it fascinating. I had heard of it, like many people, and thought it was just fascinating. And as I was doing my PhD, I needed something to focus my research on. And I thought, well, this is something I can focus my research on for a significant period of time because it's just fascinating and there's a lot to it. So that's what I did my PhD on, was dark web forensics.
Well, that's very interesting, and I applaud you. With that, if you could tell us the differences between the surface web, the deep web, the dark web, and also what Tor is.
Sure. So the surface web is also known as the visible web. You'll also hear it called the indexed web or the clear net. And this is what most people think of when they think of the internet. So anyone can access it. And our search engines, such as Google, Bing, or Yahoo, use their technology to find pages to display. So think of anything that you can Google. And the sites end in things like .com, .net, .edu, and like for DSU, .gov. So think of msn.com, our sites, dsu.edu, or for our state, sd.gov. And to reach the sites, you use a standard browser like Chrome, Edge, Internet Explorer. If you use a Mac, you use Safari or, you know, whatever your favorite browser is, Firefox. And the surface web, as of this spring, contained like around 5.27 billion pages. But that's really just a small part of the World Wide Web. It's really just the tip of the iceberg. And if you do a visual on the surface web versus the deep web versus the dark web, you'll also often see a picture of an iceberg. And the surface web's really just the very tip of that iceberg. So when you think about Googling something, think about how many pages and pages of information pop up. And that's really just a very small percentage of what's out there. And what's below that is what makes up the vast majority of the World Wide Web, and that's the deep web. And when we think of the World Wide Web, it's really just a giant way of retrieving information. So the deep web is things that are out there, and it's, you can access it, but you can't Google it, and you can't reach it with a search engine. And you either have to have a link or the right login credentials to get to it. So a good example of that would be your bank account, right? You can get to it, you have to log into it, but you're not going to Google it. You can Google your bank. So for example, US Bank or Wells Fargo, you can find their website, but you can't Google your specific bank account. You have to have your login credentials. So your bank account hides out there in the deep web, right? Medical records, student records, cloud data, any company databases, they're all out there and they're in the deep web. You can access it, but it's, you have to have the right credentials or the right link to get to it. Anything that's behind a paywall would be another example of what is out in the deep web. So subscription services like Netflix, that type of thing. A real world analogy that I like to use for the deep web is like walking down the hallway in a hotel or an apartment building. If you're in the hallway, that's like the surface web. Anybody can get to it. Anybody can walk up and down. Anybody can find it. Anybody can access it. But to go into one of those rooms, you have to have a key. That's the deep web, if that is kind of a visual that makes sense. So then we have the dark web, and it's really a very small part of what's in the deep web. The sites are often not up for very long, and they can change very frequently. So the dark web uses the same infrastructure, but it can't be accessed with a regular browser such as Chrome, Edge, or Safari. And you'd asked about Tor, and that's the most popular of the browsers to access it. But there are others. Freenet, I2P is one, although it's not used as widely. And ZeroNet is another one that is growing in popularity, I found out recently. And the other thing that's unique about the dark web are the site names or the URLs. And we already talked about the ones that like .com, .net, .edu. The Tor network, they end in .onion, which I'll explain in just a few minutes. And the site names also are not easy to remember. Like you think about the sites that we go to, like Amazon.com, Facebook.com, those are easy to remember and to type in. But the Tor URLs, up till now, they've been 16 alphanumeric characters, but they're actually, Tor is going from version 2 to version 3. And version 2 URLs were 16 characters, and they're actually version 3's 56 characters. So that's not something you're going to memorize and type in. And like I said before, they end in .onion. So Tor stands for the onion router, and which is where the .onion comes from. So when you think of those site names, when you type in like Google, it's www.google.com. So a DNS server takes that site name and converts that to an IP address, which is just a series of numbers. And it takes that IP address and it connects one IP address to another and it makes that direct connection. Well, you can look up an IP address and determine where that location is if it's a direct connection. So Tor was actually developed by the U.S. Naval Research Lab as a way for military personnel that were stationed overseas to communicate securely so their location couldn't be determined. So it was a security thing. And it's developed into a volunteer, it's run by volunteers, and it's a relay system so that you can't pinpoint a location. And when you send information over Tor, it goes through a series of 3 relays. And when information is sent over the internet, it's sent in packets. So when Tor sends something, it first wraps that packet of information in 3 layers of encryption. So it sends it through the first relay. It wraps the information in those 3 packets of encryption, sends it to the first layer. The first layer unwraps the first layer of encryption, sends it to the next node, where it unwraps the next layer of encryption, sends it to the third relay. It unwraps that third layer of encryption. And it isn't till that third node when it's fully decrypted, and that's called an exit node. And then that's when it sends it to its final destination. So the layering is where it gets the name, the onion router. It peels off those layers of encryption. So it's like peeling the layers of an onion. And that routing system is what makes it hard to follow. It's like having a path where only the only route is known is the one it's coming from, and it's the one it's going to. So since it goes through three layers, you don't know the full path. You only know where it's coming from and where it's going to. So that's why it makes it hard to follow. And with the encryption, it hides what it's sending. And then with the relays, it hides where it's going. So with those two things combined together, it has both privacy and anonymity, which then those two things combined together lend itself to that criminal activity.
So this is way beyond my skill level, but if I wanted to access the dark web, like, because it sounds so complex, I can't just go in and type whatever dot onion. Like, how does someone just access it, and how does someone sell things on the web?
Well, to access it, what you need is the Tor browser. So that's just as simple as, I mean, going out to Google. You know, you go out to Google, how do I download Tor? You just need the Tor browser. You don't have to know how it works. You just need to know, how do I get it, right? Tor needs to know how to do all those things. You just need to know, how do I get Tor? Because you don't know, you know, like how, what browser, let's say, what browser do you use? You use what for a browser?
Usually Chrome or Firefox.
Okay, so you don't need to know how Chrome connects to the internet, right? So all you need to know is, how do I get Chrome loaded on my computer? So once you load it on your computer, that's all you need to know. So once you get it loaded, it does all the work for you, right? So all you need to know is, how do I get it loaded? And it does all the work for you.
So then if I wanted to sell something on the dark web, how do I go about doing that?
I've not actually done that. My understanding is, in what I've watched and observed, it's a lot like an eBay system. Which it's been years since I've sold anything on eBay, but it's a reputation building. Just like when you sell things on eBay or Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace would be the modern day eBay. eBay still exists, of course, but it's all based on reputation, and giving good quality product is how they build their brand and build their reputation.
So I did read, actually, that like eBay or Amazon Marketplace, many of the sites have reviews of their products. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah, absolutely true. And that's how they build their brand and build their reputation. And they want to sell their product. So often they will start out on the market sites. And then I've seen where they've even gone to, once they've established that relationship with their buyer, they'll go to encrypted messaging such as Wickr, or Signal, WhatsApp, Telegram. They'll start that process on the dark web and then go to the encrypted messaging. So then once you're on the encrypted messaging, you know, that's a person-to-person transaction.
Obviously, we know that there are a lot of disreputable things being sold or being accessed on the dark web, but we're primarily interested in the purchase of substances, drugs. So one of the questions I have are the drugs sold on the dark web, are they real or are they counterfeit?
I think there's likely both. That's something we've talked about doing as a research project, is to actually do some purchasing and break down the chemical composition and see, you know, what you would find. My suspicion is you would find both, although based on the reputation system, you know, and again, wanting to build their reputation, some of the long-standing vendors, I think you would find pretty good product out there. And you know, as far as a research project, as researchers, and I'm sure you would know this, it's no more legal for us to do that than it would be for anyone else to go purchase drugs on the dark web and do that without some sort of transactional immunity. But I think you would likely find the long-established vendors would likely have good quality product, because they want, that's their business. That's what they want to do. The ones you would find giving bad product would be the ones that would pop up and, you know, sell a few times and then disappear.
So that's actually sort of begs the question, which If there are longtime vendors, I'm assuming the law enforcement knows about them, why don't they just like go in and shut them down?
Well, and again, if we go back to and talk about how Tor works, it's difficult to trace when the, you know, when you can't find the IP address, but they actually do shut them down about once a year. There's a major shutdown. If you go back to 2014, well, actually before 2014, 2013 was the first major shutdown. It was the original Silk Road website, which we haven't talked about. We can talk about. And that was called Operation Atom Bomb. 2014 was Operation Animus, and they arrested 17 people and shut down this Silk Road 2, which is the second website. Operation Pacifier was also, that started in 2014 and extended. I don't think that's even wrapped up yet. That shut down the Playpen site, which is a major child pornography site. 2016 was Operation Hyperion, shut down vendors and users. Operation Bayonet in 2017 took down Alpha Bay and Hansa. That was a huge darknet marketplace. 2018 was another operation, Operation Disarray, which targeted vendors and users. And that was first one operated in all 50 states. 2019, Operation Saboteur, 61 arrests, almost 300 kilos of drugs, 51 firearms, and more than 7 million in cryptocurrency. And the two most recent ones last almost a year ago, Operation Disruptor in 2020. That was like September of 2020. 179 individuals, 6.5 million in cash and cryptocurrency, 500 kilos of drugs worldwide, which was 274 kilos in the U.S. And it was fentanyl, oxy, hydrocodone, meth, heroin, cocaine, ecstasy, and some firearms. And then just in January, they shut down Dark Market. And that was a European-run operation. And the other thing that happens with these market sites is they will do what's called an exit scam. So they run like an escrow service. So the market site will hold the money between the vendors and the buyers until the product's delivered. So you're a vendor and I'm a buyer. You offer your product for sale. I say, yep, I'm going to buy your cocaine, let's say. And I put my money. The site holds that money until you deliver the product to me. And then I say, yep, I got my product. They release the money to you. But in the meantime, they're holding all of that money in escrow. Well, they'll do that for, you know, several months, year, year and a half. And then they can be holding several million dollars in escrow and then decide, yep, we have enough. And they close their site down and walk away. Well, who's going to complain? And who are they going to complain to, right? I mean, they're not going to call the authorities because they're vendors selling drugs and they're people purchasing drugs. So the vendors migrate to another platform and they're likely on another platform already anyway. And the buyers are going to go to another platform as well.
That just sort of sparked another issue, which is how do I pay for the drugs? I mean, so do I pay them with cryptocurrency? Do I pay with cash? And then also the flip side of that is, okay, once I've paid and everything goes fine, do they get delivered? Like when I buy something on Amazon, it gets delivered to my home. Where do they get delivered?
So if we go back to the original site that's kind of started all, it's a site called the Farmers Market. And I think that was, I want to say 2011, 2010. It was shut down in 2012 and they used cash, Western Union, PayPal, or Pecunix, which was electronic gold. And that was the one that was shut down with Operation Atom Bomb, which not a great way to pay for stuff, right? Because it's traceable. You're not going to send a Western Union receipt to somebody, right? Or PayPal, probably not the best. So the first well-known dark website was called the Silk Road. And that was, there's a book out there. It's called American Kingpin by a guy named Nick Bilton. And I listened to it on audiobook, and I've listened to it two or three times. It's really a fascinating book. And the guy's name is Ross Ulbricht, who started the Silk Road. He's quite a character. He started by growing his own magic mushrooms, and he taught himself how to code. He was really a brilliant guy. Taught himself how to code and created the website called the Silk Road himself. And it just kind of mushroomed, so to speak. The site grew in popularity and eventually had hundreds of vendors and was making millions of dollars on this website. and needed more people to help him out in the coding, and eventually, as things do, ended up drawing a lot of attention to himself, and they the Chuck Schumer took an interest in it and ended up drawing too much attention to himself, and they ultimately arrested him. He's now serving a double life sentence for his role, and they at one time contemplated selling poison, and they had spun off a second site and were selling weapons, and they drew the line. They said they would not sell credential, like stolen credentials, people's, you know, credit card information or login information, and then absolutely refused to sell like child pornography and that type of thing, which I guess they had some conscience, but they did. They arrested him, I believe it was the San Francisco Public Library, and they were able to get him hands on the keyboard. So they knew it was him. And I believe Trump was actually contemplating pardoning him before he left office. Or I shouldn't say he was contemplating. They were wondering if he would be pardoned, which he was not. It's really a fascinating book. But he was the first to accept cryptocurrency as payment. And that's what really made it take off, because at that time it was largely believed that it was untraceable. That crypto payments were untraceable. Well, that has since been proven not quite to be true. It's more difficult to trace, but it's not untraceable. And now people have started using crypto tumblers and things like that to make it more difficult to trace than cash or Western Union. So, but to answer your question, crypto is how people pay for things bought on dark web marketplaces. And then as far as shipment, they will, again, like many criminals, it depends on their sophistication. They'll ship it to their homes. It's shipped through U.S. Postal Service because it's often not inspected. And it depends on where it's shipped. Some post offices don't inspect like others do, and some don't watch, like they should, depending on the area of the country you live in. And some will ship just to a P.O. box. I've seen them come. I was able to sit in on an interview with a young man in a small community here in South Dakota. And it just so happened the day we were interviewing him, he had a shipment come in. It was priority mail envelope. And they, asked him, can we open this? Yep. Open it up, and a shrink wrap package of, I believe they were Oxy pills, if my memory serves. It was either Oxy or fentanyl. I believe it was Oxy. Just shrink wrapped. It was several hundred pills in the package.
Professionally done.
And they'll often obfuscate them in other things. They'll be, within a shoebox, with a pair of shoes, or, it's not always so obvious, but yeah, it comes right through the mail.
So this is all very, to me, complex, right? Why wouldn't I just go to my local, street corner and just buy from somebody there where I have cash and I know the person and it's there immediately? Because I need it immediately. Is it safer to do it on the web? It's certainly not less complex.
Right. Well, and that's another good question. The same young man that we were interviewing, we asked that question, like, why would you go to all this trouble to do that? And his perception was that it's safer to do it that way. And if you think about it, nobody's going to pull a gun on you if you order it off the dark web. It comes right to your mailbox. So you're sitting behind, and it's the ones we often see, the cases I've worked that we've had that deal with people buying on the dark web are often under 30. So these are kids that they've grown up with technology. So it may sound complicated. It's not complicated for them, right? They can show us how to do stuff. So it's not that complicated, and it's not, there's nobody's going to hurt them physically. But I think about it, you're still putting something into your body that's from a source you don't know where it came from. So, I mean, safety is, it depends on if you're talking about your physical safety or, it's all in the perception, I think.
Yeah, that's actually what I was just going to say, is that you don't know where you're getting it from. If you have a relationship with a dealer, you know what you're getting. So I guess you're right. It depends on how you define safety.
Right. Exactly.
I just wanted to just say this to the listeners too. I read that the University of Texas Health Center at Houston recently found 250,000 listings of drugs from 10 anonymous online marketplaces, and 30,000 of those were opioids. If the University of Texas can find that so quickly and easily, again, I'm just, why aren't those like immediately shut down? As far as I know, they're still up.
Right. Yep. And again, it's, you know, it goes back to Tor and how the IP addresses are hard to find. And then often they're run out of foreign countries. So those countries may or may not want to cooperate. So if they're run out of a basement in Bulgaria, first of all, are you finding the correct location? Because it's not always easy to find. And then will that country cooperate with you in shutting that down? Sometimes they will and sometimes they won't, because those IP addresses can be masked to not really know it. Is that really the location? And then will that country cooperate with you? And they do shut them down. It just doesn't happen immediately. So they do. But it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You shut one down and then the next one pops up. So one of my former colleagues who had been in law enforcement for many years equated the dark web to a crack neighborhood. That's the kind of the crack neighborhood of the internet. You know, it's, and there have been good things that have come out of the dark web as far as, you know, encrypted messaging and, you know, countries where, you know, we think of everything in terms of how we view it in the United States with our freedoms. And, you know, if we want to look something up on the internet, we look it up, right? We can find anything we want. Well, we don't live in North Korea or China or countries where our internet access is restricted. So if you live in those countries and want to look something up, you may need to use Tor or one of those other forms to be able to freely access information that your government restricts or watches everything you do. So that's, you know, kind of a flip side of Tor and the dark web is some of that communication or outside communication that you may be seeking. That might be the only way you can find it.
Yeah, I never even thought of that way.
Yeah, we tend to think of everything in terms of, you know, our freedoms here. But having said that, that's a small percentage of, my view is that's a small percentage of what it gets used for.
For individuals who work in public health and public safety fields, like myself, is it safe to explore on the dark web?
Well, and again, in terms of your physical safety, certainly it's safe. Having said that, I am very careful about what I go to, because you cannot unsee something you accidentally see, right? If you get into the wrong thing and click on something, you can't pretend like you didn't see it. So, and some of the forum sites, people, they're not censored. So people post anything they want to. And I just think in terms of like the casework we do here, like I said, we don't do ICAC exams, but even the casework we do, a lot of the things that we see can be kind of disturbing. And I don't always find the images that we do disturbing, but often it's some of the chat information that we have to read through can be disturbing. So the forum sites are where people just post, it's text, but they say whatever they want to say. And there may or may not be images in there. So it can be a little, you know, if you think about people saying anything they want to say uncensored, it can be a little disturbing. And you can, you know, get into things that it can be a rabbit hole that you can get down to. So, you know, safe physically, yeah, definitely. But I'd just be a little careful. And that's really a personal question, you know, like what can you handle personally? And then the other thing to be aware of is many of those dark web sites are riddled with malware, like malicious software. So you can, you know, end up with a nasty computer virus if you're not careful. So accessing it through a standalone machine that you can just reinstall if you need to, or a virtual machine is definitely a best practice for that.
So I think based on what you're saying, I'm going to stick to Amazon and eBay.
I mean, it's fascinating. I find it interesting. And I definitely stick to the PG version of the dark web. You know, there's a lot of nooks and crannies that I just don't go, because I don't need to see that. I know it's out there. I work with one of my colleagues here has been in ICAC for more than a dozen years. And I know what he does. And I know what he sees. And I don't need to see that. I just don't. I know, and thank goodness he does what he does, because it's necessary and it's growing and it's horrifying, but I don't need to see it. I'm just very careful about what I get into. And I know what, from working with he and a lot of his colleagues, I know what some of those keywords are. So I know what to stay away from. So I find the market sites just fascinating. So I tend to stick to that. And some of the, you know, we watch for credential leaks and that type of thing in other areas of what we do here at Dakota State. So I find that fascinating that somebody will just post somebody's credentials out there. And so we monitor some of that stuff for businesses here in the state as well. So that's more of what I stick to. And there's plenty of that out there as well. So I find that interesting. It's just a fascinating, because like you said, how can all this be out there and nobody can do anything about it? But it just is.
Yeah, if the bad guys only use their brains for good, it'd be way better.
Right? I say that frequently, yeah.
So before we wrap up, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you think listeners might be interested in or should hear?
Just like we said, you know, it is a rabbit hole. And just be aware of what you're getting yourself into if you do decide to go explore. When I did the previous webinar, there was some pointed questions, you know, like what sites can I find and what can I, you know, and I just wasn't going to go there because, you know, it's not a how-to guide to get on the dark web. That wasn't my intention. You can find that if you want to, but it is the rabbit hole. So just if you do decide to go explore, just be careful and know what you're getting yourself into. I think it's kind of the sexy topic, if you will. And it is interesting. And I think many of us have heard of it, but it's like, you know, what is it? What is that that's out there?
Yeah, until I attended the webinar that you led, I really had heard of it. I didn't know much about it. I didn't know the difference between deep and dark web. So I thank you for educating me and educating our listeners. This has been really great and actually fascinating. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you to Dr. Erica Culm, Lead Digital Forensic Analyst in the Digital Forensics Lab in the Department of Research and Economic Development at Dakota State University, for being here with me today and for presenting fascinating information on drugs on the dark web. Please join us for the next One-on-One with LAPA, where we will discuss another topic of interest.